There are several rites of passage that each of us goes through in our life, from birth to death, graduation, marriage, and so many steps along the way when we change from one stage to another. And on Hometown Alaska today, we're going to be talking about the most difficult one for the people that are left behind, and in some ways the most challenging one to navigate because there's so little information that is shared about dying. My name is Charles Woolforth, and I've got guests in the studio to talk about each aspect of preparing for a family member's death, dealing with the actual death, and the arrangements that take place in the grieving process. And we hope to hear from you because this is something that each and every one of us will deal with. Let's talk about it. Let's get the information we need to deal with it intelligently, and although there's no way to take away the pain, to at least make it a little bit easier to navigate. So that's our topic, and I'm going to give out the phone number and email address in just a moment, but I first want to introduce our guest. Reverend Michael Burke is the rector of St. Mary's Episcopal Church. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
Thank you, Charles. It's wonderful to be on.
Amanda Richmond is with Hospice of Anchorage and an RN, right?
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Scott Jansen is well known as the Mushin Mortician, and he drove up with his dog truck today. He's also the owner of Jansen Funeral Homes. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
Well, thanks, Charles. I think this is an important subject for people to touch on, and hopefully we'll have some good calls.
Yeah. Well, if you want to get on the air with us, the phone number here is 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. So if you're in town, it's 550-8433. Michael, let's just begin with talking about, you perform the full range of pastoral care for a large congregation, and obviously dealing with death is only one of the many things you deal with, mm-hmm. but I bet it's something that is particularly tough and is something that people don't really want to talk about, don't want to prepare for. Do you see that on a sort of a day-to-day basis?
And yet it'll happen to all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think part of the reason it's problematic is because we live in a culture that has a complicated and an often conflicted relationship with dying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that's will be a reality for each and every one of us, and yet we act in much of our lives as though that's not the case, as if somehow talking about it will make it more likely.
Right. And then when someone that we love is very ill, all we want to think about is them getting better. And one of the big challenges of that passage, of that stage, is changing that conversation. Is that something you're involved with when you're working with parishioners?
Yeah, I think that's a very much a part of the whole pastoral continuum of conversations with people. It's very difficult when the person who is dying, who is preparing for their death, is at a point where they're both willing and ready to talk about those subjects, but the loved ones around them are still very, very uncomfortable. It's often said that, please don't talk about that. That's morbid.
Right.
Or though, as somehow our loved one will give up hope or hasten their own death by talking about the process they're going through in preparing to die. I mean, death as part of life is a holy experience. It's a deeply spiritually transformative experience. So just on that aspect alone, leaving aside all of the legal and the medical and the palliative kinds of parts that are also part of it. But just looking at the emotional and the psychological and the spiritual preparation, it's awkward when the person who knows their death is coming and is ready to prepare in a very active way to be an active participant in their life story, even up into writing the ending. And yet the loved ones are still very conflicted about that. It creates a difficult pastoral situation. And mm-hmm. I think you have to go in and get people willing to talk about this.
Right. So it seems to me that in this situation and sort of having addressed it with family members and friends, it's sort of asking questions and listening. You know, it's not something you can push somebody towards, right? Is that how you deal with it as a counselor?
Yeah, well, that's very true. I mean, you have to, I think, be alert to when a person is ready to begin talking about that. And you have to make it clear that even if no one else in their life is ready to listen, that you are, and that you know, you're comfortable having those conversations. It's enough for the person to manage their own fears and anxieties without having to manage yours.
Right. Yeah. So it's a lot of what we're going to talk about today is about the kind of gift you can give to your loved ones in terms of helping them through this. And it's not only the person who's dying, but the people who are going to be grieving need that help. And so it's all about giving, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And there is so much. We'll cover that in the course of the show, I expect. But there are so many different aspects and elements to preparing for a good death. And to see that as a deeply transformative experience. It can transform our relationships, our past hurts and regrets. It can be, you know, up until the very last, a really second chance and a moment to rewrite your life story and your life script.
So make it that rather than a time that creates regrets.
That's correct.
Yeah. Amanda, I want to turn to you with Hospice of Anchorage. I think it's important to just start by letting people know what hospice is, how it functions. So give us a little bit of the overview.
Sure. A lot of people, and like Pastor was saying, we are a death-denying society. And I have found that the word hospice has a lot of negative connotations to it, a lot of misunderstandings. If you approach a patient or family and say the word hospice, it's very scary because at that moment they feel like, I'm dying. You know, palliative and hospice are different, different services. The palliative is more of when we know that there's going to be death in the nearer future. However, your services are, you can also be using curative services at that time. Hospice is usually generally where we move. The curative is no longer a viable option that we're using, and death is probably more imminent. Without getting into regulations, of course, with our health care that you have to consider, hospice is, and palliative services, is really a holistic view of a patient's life, and it encompasses their family, their children, their pets. It's a completely well-rounded way of looking at someone who is facing illness, and how to not focusing on dying, but actually focusing on living. We're focusing on living to the best that we can. And like Pastor also said, a lot of things towards the end of life that's not even concerned on a medical spectrum is your faith, questions, is relationships that might have been left opened, things that you really do need to sort through. And some people will come to that kind of meeting point when they are facing that situation to where I might not be here.
Yeah. Where does it take place? Is it in your facility? Is it home?
Hospice, you know, for me, it's a state of mind, actually. We do, in this area in Anchorage, Providence does have a palliative care services team. Hospice of Anchorage is your community services. Generally seeing adults and sending a team member out with social work, grief and bereavement counselor, and working with nursing services to see these patients and to just try to get all aspects of what they need taken care of. And also with that, with the family. So you have more than just one patient. So Hospice of Anchorage will go out to the home and see people and go ahead and coordinate those needs that they have medically, community-minded needs. Perhaps they need a bed or they need a wheelchair, and coordinate those kinds of services.
So when does someone have to make that decision? I mean, you can't make it on a dime, right? You've got to sort of plan a little bit, or how does that come about when making that decision, being in the hospital, deciding you're going to end curative care? Presumably you're well enough to leave the hospital at that point, right? You don't have to stay in the hospital. When do you have to make that choice, and how does it come about? I guess it's paid for by insurance, right?
Sure. Actually, Hospice of Anchorage is a nonprofit organization. All of our services are free of charge. So we are funded by private and grants. I'm not going to speak for any of the other kind of hospice because I don't know their regulations. So the nice thing about us is that we don't have those stipulations.
Okay.
If you are still seeking curative treatment, we still can be referred and be of service. We want to manage pain. We want to make sure you're comfortable. If you are still seeking curative treatments and you're not comfortable, there's a problem and we need to address that. Mm-hmm. So we really work as a team, interdisciplinary team together to kind of meet all those needs. And with our chaplain that comes along, you know, meeting those faith-based needs, nursing services, meeting those questions that you might have about what treatment you're going through, or calling to tell me, I'm really nauseated because of this medication. What can I do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's my role, is to come in on that medical perspective and take a look at what's going on and figure it out.
Wow. So do you have the capacity to deal with anybody who calls up, that you can sort of go out and help them? Or how do you deal with the fact that you're a free service and there's a lot of people who need it?
Sure. You know, not everyone's going to be appropriate for these services. If you are at end of life and doctors are saying that you're very short term with that, you probably could be provided with better care through a different Providence agency that would provide you with hospice care. Ours is more on the palliative end because we are 8 to 5 Monday through Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So you will want, if you are needing that 24-hour coverage, you would probably be best served.
How do you figure that out? If you're a family member and you know nothing about this and you're suddenly thrust into this situation, how do you sort of figure out what the options are and make the best choices?
You know, hopefully your primary care physician or anyone who sees you in the hospital has let you know that hospice could be of service to you. A lot of times we'll get referrals from physicians. It's certainly a family member could call us and say, hey, my mom is ill. We're not quite sure what's going on. And get us involved. We are more than happy to come out, sit down, discuss options, discuss things, get medical records, and go from there to get you the best kind of care that you need at this moment, at this time. And it really is meeting someone where they are. Some people may have family members that are ready to explore end of life, and the patient might not be. So you always have to remember that you will have differing places of where someone is coming from, and just having to meet them where they are.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get to my third guest, but I wanted to bring this question back to Reverend Michael Burke. It seems to me that doctors sometimes are not ready to deal with this issue. So they may, even beyond where the patient is, they may still be pushing for more cure, or they just may not be comfortable saying, you know what, at least in plain language where everyone can understand, I can't help you anymore. Do you encounter that?
Well, I certainly don't want to speak for doctors, and medical training, I understand, has changed tremendously through the decades. But the traditional model a generation or so ago was focused on the physician's role in healing. So in one way of looking at it, I guess death is a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the entire system is set up that the doctor's job is to heal. So once your diagnosis is at the point where we know that healing isn't a realistic option, at least in terms of physical healing, then what is the doctor's role? And of course, medical education has now changed dramatically. And I think doctors are doing a much better job in understanding the role of care throughout all of life, including the dying process.
Yeah. It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about the details of dying. And if you'd like to get on the show with Reverend Michael Burke from St. Mary's Episcopal Church, Amanda Richmond from Hospice of Anchorage, or Scott Jensen of Jensen Funeral Homes, the phone number here is 550-8433. Statewide, it's 888-353-5752. Email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. All questions are welcome. No dumb questions today, because this is something that none of us knows all that much about. Also, comments and points of view, welcome as well. Scott, you're the Mushin Mortician, and I put your Facebook page up on our website at alaskapublic.org. So, of course, I expected a guy in a black suit with a pallid complexion, but you don't seem that way at all. Your job Well, just explain what your job is, really.
Well, I moved to Alaska in 1985, straight out of college at the University of Minnesota. I have a Bachelor of Science degree with a major in mortuary science. In Alaska, I'm both a licensed embalmer and a licensed funeral director. The term for that is a mortician. I have used the old term for years, that being I'm an undertaker. And I will say it in the easiest way, and this is the way my oldest daughter Angela said when she was in kindergarten, when uncoached, when people would ask her, "What does your daddy do?" She would say, "He helps people when they're really sad." Mm-hmm. And so basically the essence of being a funeral director comes down to making people as comfortable as possible on the worst day of their life. When I meet with people and I tell them I'm a funeral director, I'm an undertaker, my typical term, I get all kinds of reactions because I and all of us in the funeral profession, we represent death. We are in essence the Grim Reaper. But what we're there for is to help people through this. Most people don't want to talk about death. No, most people don't want to talk about their own death. I'll use the example of my father. My father, I asked him for years, you know, Dad, what kind of funeral do you want to have? And Dad would always say, oh, just put me in a pine box and bury me at the lake cabin. So I'd respond to him, well, Dad, number one, we can't bury you at the lake cabin. There's not a cemetery there. And number two, is that really what you want, Dad? So one year we were deer hunting, and my dad is hard of hearing, speaks very loud. And sitting there at the deer hunting stand while we were posting early in the morning, Dad told me what he wanted as a funeral. He told me who he wanted as pallbearers. He went through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't have it written down, but I know what Dad wants. Mm-hmm. And that's the hard thing for people. You know, I'll go back to what you started out with saying was, you know, the big things in our life, the graduation ceremonies. Let's go back further. Baptism, confirmation, graduation from high school, college, marriage, all of the things we do. There's planning that goes into that. There's planning that goes into it, you know? Mm-hmm. I run the Iditarod. This is going to be my fifth Iditarod. And believe me, the planning starts the day the race ends the year before. So why don't we plan for our own eventual demise? You know, the death rate in Anchorage, Alaska is exactly the same as my hometown of Crookston, Minnesota, which surprisingly is exactly the same as New York City, Atlanta, because the death rate is 100%. Right. We're all going to go. So we need to face that. But typically when I speak to groups, and I do a lot of public speaking, and I speak to groups and I talk to them about the fact that I'm here as a funeral director today talking about a hard subject for all of you. And I don't want people to go home and be worried about death or grandmother or whoever, but to look at this realistically. Take the information away from this talk and use that information because it is a gift. If you make your own prearrangements, I have seen families break up in the arrangement office. And if you right. make your prearrangements ahead of time, you're going to help everything go smoother because all the kids are going to know this is what your plans are. So to confront death, to look at the fact that I'm 53 years old. I mean, the average age last year of all the people we served through our funeral homes in this city, throughout the entire state, the average age was only 57 years old. In 1985, the average age was only 32 years old, and I was 24 when I got up here. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, as far as the average age, we're much younger than the funeral homes that deal with people outside the state.
Let's take a call here. I have many more questions for you, Scott, but I want to see what Mary has to say. Mary?
Hi. I've experienced a lot of being by the deathbed of family members and friends, and I think the one thing that I'm always struck by, and maybe the panel can address this, is the dying process. People often sometimes think that it's really quick, and it could actually sometimes even last years or certainly months. And I was wondering if the panel can address that.
It's not like on TV. That's answer number one, right?
No, not at all like TV.
Amanda, will you want to take that one?
Sure. You're right, Mary. First of all, thank you for calling in. And I'm sure your loved ones are very, very much aware of you being there for them, which is the best thing you can do. Yes, that is a very hard one. In fact, we are trying to start seeing pediatric patients and dealing with the actual death, like you had brought up. you're going to have it different in every single person. You're going to have to deal with what is that person's basic disease process. Where are we starting at? Where are we now? And like you said, it can...
No, go ahead.
Oh, it can change. You can see someone, and you can also have peaks and valleys where you will see someone come and they will be better from maybe an acute illness, but they still have that underlying disease process. And that will all affect that actual dying process. So, you know, people try to stay days or weeks, and really none of us can say that. And if anyone could, I want to know them, because, you know.
But it goes into this whole thing, like, when do the family members come from outside? Everybody wants to be at the bedside, but it's tough. You can't really time it. You don't really know what's going to happen.
It is tough, and I don't think there is a timing per se. You really can sometimes be able to get a grasp when you are seeing that person and you are seeing some symptoms occur that you can kind of get that.
And I guess I would, and you, the experts can disagree with me, but I mean, maybe it's important not to be hung up on that particular moment, but in fact be with the person, say goodbye, have some good time. And that's probably more important than that you were sitting there at that exact moment.
Right, well, Michael? And sometimes we're not able to be there at the exact moment that a person passes. I've been with people during the dying process where the family gathers and is present 24 hours for 4, 5, 6, 7 days. I'm thinking of one woman in particular who is a very introverted and a very private person. And she waited until that one moment on the fifth day when the family members left for not more than 5 minutes, because she wanted to pass in with just herself. It was a very private and personal moment for her. And the family felt torn with a tremendous amount of guilt that we shouldn't have gone down to the cafeteria. We should have stayed there. And I had to find a way to point out that, you know, your mother was waiting for that moment to be alone.
Right.
Give people that opportunity.
Well, this is something that's hard to, we have such a sort of medical and scientific view of this process, but it does seem like the person a lot of times is a bit in control, isn't it? They want permission, or they want to know everybody's going to be okay, or they want, like you say, privacy. And then when they've got all this, all what they need, then they'll go and die, as if they can make that decision.
I don't know that that's the case for
not
all
always,
people in all situations, but, in 20 years or so of being a pastor, I've seen enough of situations to know that a person whose death was medically told to be imminent would hang on 4, 5, 6, 7 days until that one relative that they really wanted to see arrived at their bedside, had an opportunity to say goodbye, and within the hour passed away.
Yeah.
So I think there is a degree of control exercised by the person who is dying.
Well, and I agree with that too, but I think too alongside of that is the psychological factors that happen, and that being, as a funeral director up here for so long, when the weather changes. When the weather changes and we go through, or a holiday season, and people that hold on, and they hold on and through significant willpower, and they hold on until those people come to visit, until that holiday is over, until the blue sky goes away, and all of a sudden things get a little bit dreary. And we see that there are more of the home deaths, more of the expected deaths. And with that word, we're talking about expected deaths, about hospice. And I'll go into a little bit. I used to be a board member for many years for Hospice of Anchorage, and always been a supporter of Hospice of Anchorage. I believe in them very fully. As a funeral director coming here in 1985, very few people in the 80s had the opportunity, and I will use that word again, the opportunity to die in the comfort of their own surroundings, to be able to die at home rather than institutionalized. When I graduated from college in 1985, we talked about the fact that death is institutionalized, and death is institutionalized. You die at the hospital, the funeral home has to come and remove the remains from the hospital, and many times because of the uncomfortableness around it, the people, and it is nothing against the people at the hospitals. They all do a great job. But it's a natural thing to try to buffer the people from the hard parts.
Right.
I believe that the family needs to be as involved as possible. In the 80s, when I would go to a home and I would remove a deceased individual from a home, I would explain to the family what we're going to do. And I'd explain that, you know, you folks might want to go over in the other room. And, you know, sorry to put on the funeral voice, but you talk to people calmly and very gently. You folks might want to go into the other room, and we're going to have to remove Dad, and we'll place him onto our cot. And I'd explain exactly what we're doing. And something that we always do is we don't even wheel the cot in and out of the house, because I don't want the tracks in the carpet. Mm-hmm. I don't want the tracks on the floor. I don't want that reminder constantly coming back and forth. And so now, I started this way back in the late 80s and 90s, is I asked the family to come in and to help us, so that they can have some hands-on. You know, our culture, many, many years ago, that's what we did.
Right.
That's why we're called undertakers, is as we moved west, we didn't have the big parlors for the church
services.
And it's
that physical contact that helps you deal with it and know it really happened.
I
want to go to another call here. Alice is calling from Palmer. And did you have a question, Alice?
Yes. I wondered what the laws were for having as much of a natural burial as possible, meaning no embalming, maybe a basket instead of a wooden casket to, you know, let the worms take over and get back to nature, you know, in a more natural way. What are the laws for that? Thank you.
Scott?
Well, in Alaska, we're fortunate as a state here to be able to, we can take care of everything, in that being we as family members. So all the way to the point that the family members could remove the deceased individual from the place of death. The family members could make their own casket, coffin, basket, whatever you're thinking that way. We in the funeral industry call that the green burial. That everything, and we even have caskets that don't have any metal in them, that are designed to break down faster. But the thing is that when death occurs in a hospital or an institution, the family doesn't have any way to transport the remains from the place of death, whether it be the operating room, what have you. In those cases, and it probably happens from, I'd say, up to 5 times a year, and families will call us and ask, and if they really want to take care of things themselves, then I just ask them to let us go up and remove the person from the place of death, so that they are then picking up the person. They bring the container to us, they place them into the container, and they're able to do everything the way that our culture always used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to facilitate that for people. There is no law concerning embalming. There is, and that is if a person dies of a contagious disease, and that being going back to smallpox and some diseases like that. Very much so, that is not something that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. So yes, that is 100% possible. You can do that through a funeral home, or you can do that through yourselves. And I encourage anybody that would be thinking of that to call us, and we can help them along that path.
Interesting. I didn't know that. This has been a good hour to learn things. And we have more callers coming in, and we're going to, in the second half of the show, here, hopefully, you, the listeners, can drive our show today and help us figure out what we want to talk about. If not, I have a ton of questions. I want to talk about the grieving process and how you get help for that. When do you know, when is it over? Is it ever over? Maybe not. And also the actual, Scott was talking a little bit about the actual dying and sort of those practical, physical things you have to get through. So plenty of topics to talk about with my three guests, Reverend Michael Burke from St. Mary's Episcopal Church, Amanda Richmond from Hospice of Anchorage, and Scott Jansen, the mush and mortician from Jansen Funeral Homes. Here on Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Woolforth. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. Today we're talking about the details of dying, and we've got an excellent panel in the studio today for the before, the during, and the after. And no question is off bounds. We're trying to really make sure that our listeners know what they need to know to deal with something that is going to happen to each of us and also happen to our loved ones. And as Reverend Michael Burke said in the first half, how do you make it a good death? We know what's going to happen. Let's make it as good as it can be. Maybe deal with those issues that you needed to deal with all the rest of your life. So it's Reverend Michael Burke from St. Mary's Episcopal Church, Amanda Richmond from Hospice of Anchorage, and Scott Jansen from Jansen Funeral Homes. I'm Charles Woolforth. And if you want to get on the show with us, the phone number here is 550-8433. And if you're outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now let's go to Penny. Penny, did you have a question?
I do, and I would like to ask Scott Jansen. I have donated my body to a specific place, but it's down in Oregon. And I have asked them, I used to live in Oregon. They deal with a death in Alaska. My question is about logistics. Do you come and pick up me after I'm dead and ship me down there, or how does this work?
Well, that's exactly what happens, and we do work with the facilities, and in fact, Oregon has come up many times with us. And so what happens is they would contact us, and we'd be contacted by the next of kin, and they would know then that the anatomical gift has been given, which I hope you've passed on to your next of kin. And so then we would be contacted by the program, and then they would direct us as to what they want us to do. For example, a decedent that donates their remains could sometimes be used for study, and that being like the anatomy classes that I had when I was in college. In those cases, the embalming is done to preserve the remains without the intrusion of any vessels other than the arteries that are used for embalming. Sometimes they need the remains to not be embalmed, and in that case, they would direct us to use a certain amount of dry ice, typically 15 pounds of dry ice, and then we place that, shroud the remains, and ship the remains down to the center. In Oregon, in our experience, they typically pay for the remains to be sent down, and that's what they do to give back for the anatomical gift.
All right. Thanks, Penny. That was a good question, and we've got several more callers, but that was such a good segue into something else we wanted to talk to that I want to turn to each of my guests now to address, you know, what should we do to prepare for our own deaths? This is, you know, when someone has died that you love, you are not in a good position to make decisions, right? I think we could all agree with that. So if those decisions have been made, it's going to be a lot easier. And Michael, you were talking about there's things as detailed as making sure you've written down your online passwords. What are some of the key things you think are important to prepare?
Well, of course, there's all the legal considerations you have to do. There's the considerations about what kind of services and support you'd like to have during the dying process. Perhaps most important in a place, I believe that's an important place to start, is conversations with your loved ones. That helps them, even though today they may not be ready and willing to have this conversation. When this conversation gets going, it's an opportunity to talk about what it is you would like to see. Rather than allow death to be something that completely happens to you and you're a passive and a powerless participant in that, to take an active role. That just opens up a floodgate of possibilities. Some of the examples that you might want to think about is how are you going to be looked after in your last days? Who will speak and act for you when you can no longer do so for yourself? Scott raised the question of where do you want to die? You don't need to die in a hospital in many cases. Dying at home is an option. How will your body be cared for? Burial or cremation? Where do you want your remains placed? Even down to the point of who do you want notified in the event of your death? Nowadays, because so much of our lives is lived in an online context, Does anyone have your passwords for your social media accounts? Conversations about what do you want to happen to your Facebook page after you die? Some cases, people have all the family photos in online storage. But if they pass and no one has that password, all of that is irretrievable. So there's a number of different things that need to be talked about. And there's planning booklets, and people can help you in this conversation with your loved ones. The important thing is to start now, not wait until decrepitude or dementia or some other circumstance makes it too late.
Right.
Well, and along those same lines is also the planning for even the smaller things like your personal belongings. I'll use my grandmother as an example. My grandmother, my mom, and her brother and sisters are all very close. And when I talked to Grandma before she died back in 94, I asked Grandma, I said, "How you doing, Grandma?" And she goes, "Well, I'm doing pretty good, Scott, but I don't think I have long left, and I'm really scared." And I said, "Grandma, what are you scared for? You've lived a wonderful life." And I tried to encourage her to be open, which she was. What she was scared of was dying in the winter. She didn't want to be placed into that building, the storage. I was able to tell Grandma that actually the cemetery in our hometown buries in the winter now. It was able to relieve her because she opened up about that. And then we talked about the different things. And I said, "Grandma, this is my suggestion to you." And I told her what I said earlier, and that I've seen families break up in the arrangement office. I said, "Grandma, you got all this cool stuff in your house. You got all these grandchildren, you got your son, you got your daughters." I said, "I'd suggest to you to go through the house." And I gave her a whole bunch of these, you know, the little white stickies you'd put on the top of a file, you type the information on. I gave her a whole packet of these that I had in my briefcase. And I said, "I would suggest you go through and write down the name of who you want to get what in the house."
And even if you don't care, all the pain you're going to be suffering, saving by making those decisions so that the kids and the grandkids don't have to do
it. And then everybody was happy. Mm-hmm. They knew, "Oh, Grandma wanted us to get this." Right. Down to that detail. But the other thing is all of the abilities that we have these days to get insurance. People that go into a credit card and they take out the insurance for $3.65 a month, what have you. Tell your next of kin this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. List this information down. And if you specifically want certain things done at the time of your death, you need to put it legally in your will. You need to do that. People just don't do it. They think, "Well, the kids will take care of that sort of thing." And then what happens when the kids take care of things? Things get overwhelmed. Problems occur.
Amanda, give us some of your thoughts on this preparation question, what things that folks should think about.
Well, you know, when you're looking at the aspect of patients that are looking at a life-limiting disease, so we're dealing with that. And then if you're dealing with preparation of any of us, no matter the age, no matter whether we have any disease processes going on. So I think that it's important, and we'll just go ahead and look at that all of us need to be looking at. And like Scott and Pastor said, it's so important to go ahead and get those things ready, to have things in line, because the family members that you are leaving behind will have so much stress of, "Did I do it the way they wanted me to do it?" Mm-hmm. And to be able to lift that stress off is huge. And to be able to say what you wanted so that they don't have to guess, I believe, would leaves it a lot easier for your family members that are having to cope with funeral arrangements, you know, credit cards, bank accounts, those types of things. And so really, I think all of us would be doing a great service to those who love us by writing these things down, putting our passwords down, and all of those small details that we really just don't think about.
Let's go to a call from Mary. Mary, you had a question for Scott, our the resident undertaker?
Yes, this is a positive. My husband was killed on active duty in 79. I had wonderful service. I had a mortuary officer assigned to me. And also my husband's ashes were spread from a plane up at Arctic Valley. So I had a very positive experience, though it was stressful and unexpectedly when he died on active duty. But I don't want to... I'm a second wife to a man who died in 2004, and I would not want this to happen to anyone else. My husband died on a Sunday in 2004. I had called his daughter from out of state, from Wyoming, and she flew up, and he died that same day after much arguments. apparently they had gotten to the funeral home before me, put in their own obituary. They did put my name in, and they scheduled a memorial service at the senior center that Friday. I was unaware of the obituary or the service until later that Saturday. I was quite distraught over my husband's death. I had to seek medical care, and I was in the hospital for 3 days, and I found that very, very embarrassing that a memorial service had been held for my husband. I was not invited. I was unaware of it until the following Saturday. So what I'm asking is, what are the rights of the second wives over the immediate family if there's a conflict or something going on at the time of death? I found it very heartbreaking to me and a great embarrassment because my husband was very prominent in the community, and I still grieve not being able to attend his service. I did have a service in Cooper Landing a couple of months later.
I'm sorry, so Mary. That is a very sad story, and thanks for sharing it with us. Let's let Scott's answer.
And my condolences to you, Mary. And sadly, this sort of thing does happen. This sort of thing happens. It doesn't happen a lot. But what happens as a funeral director is when the family comes in to meet with us, there's a certain amount of trust that we have to place in that family. And a family member comes in to us and they say, we're the immediate next of kin. Now, as far as legal responsibility, as soon as a person dies, the legal definition of that is that the person becomes the property of the next of kin. That meaning the next of kin and the legal next of kin goes directly to the wife. Second wife or not, you were the one that was married to him, and you had the legal responsibility, and you were the one that should have made, you should have had the opportunity to make all of those decisions. But sometimes we run into those situations where the kids jump ahead.
Yes, doesn't happen. The only guy, the only daughter.
Exactly.
Yeah, my husband was much older, and I was quite young when I was native, and he was white, and it was just a real, and he was wealthy, and I was not, and it was just a real hard time. I just want to make sure that this never happens to anyone else ever again, that you know, make sure that there, if there is a second wife, that she at least has the input or, and will share with the family the obituary and where the services should be held instead of finding out afterwards. That was very hurtful to me.
Oh, exactly. And these days now, you know, with the advent of Google, we're able to go in and we're able to search next of kin.
And
you know, that causes problems when we question if someone is the right person to make the arrangements. But we can work that over because people understand when it comes down to it the reason why we are digging in to get that information. There has even been times where we've required a marriage certificate. Mm-hmm. You know, people that say they're still married and they're not, and then there's another person involved. But we do that just because of that abuse of that trust. And I'm so sorry that you went through that.
Well, with lots of therapy and good friends, I've gotten through it. But thank you for helping me, and I hope this doesn't happen to anybody else.
Yeah, I
agree. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Scott Jensen was just speaking from Jensen Funeral Homes. Amanda Richmond from Hospice of Anchorage is here, as well as Reverend Michael Burke from St. Mary's Episcopal Church. If you would like to get on the air with us, we still have about 15 minutes left. The phone number here is 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'd like to turn to Judith, who has a question or a comment about pet therapy. Judith?
Hi. I was just wondering, I've known in the past that in some places when a doctor or someone is explaining to the family, and especially when small children are there, that they like to bring in a pet therapy animal to help with that discussion, and I was wondering if they were doing that in part of hospices. Also, I think that it helps at the funeral home, too, to have such a non-judgmental being at that place and time when you're going through such distressing conversations.
That's a good question, and maybe we can expand it. Also for Amanda and Michael, like, what are some other things that we can do to make it easier, make these decisions, discussions easier? Who wants to take that one first?
You know, people who love pets, they love their pets. And I think that they are just as valuable to someone who puts value in them. And if you wanted that kind of pet therapy, I would say request that. Don't ever be afraid to not voice that is something that is important to you. For instance, and like we were talking about, writing down with your planning. If you wanted to write down things that were important to you, go ahead and write down, it's important for me to have my cat with me, my dog with me, my bird with me. Hospital policy, I'm not sure, but always ask. As far as Hospice of Anchorage, we're coming out to your home. So we're going to be more than happy to, you know, whatever therapies that you would like to use for comfort and or for feeling the best you can, we would like to employ.
Michael, and this one in any other ways that you're aware of to sort of make it easier?
Yeah, I think that when we look at the legal aspects and the funeral planning and the advance directives and all of that, just not to lose sight of what many consider the most important and powerful part of the process of dying, and that's the spiritual elements. Dying, especially if you have the situation or perhaps gift of knowing that your death is coming and to live into that experience is a really holy and transformative spiritual experience. But it really raises an opportunity that we get every day but don't think about to talk about and to grapple with issues of forgiveness. Are there people in my life that I need to forgive, not for their sake, not because they deserve it, but because that's a burden that I've carried for far too long. And now I'm at a point in my life where I really need to release that to make amends with those we've hurt, wherever that might not hurt or harm or embarrass them further, to cultivate a sense of beauty and holiness in the present moment. We spend so much of our lives either thinking about the past or thinking and planning for the future. The gift of knowing you're dying is the preciousness of the here and now. And to take that opportunity to either develop or renew or restore your relationship with God, however it is you understand God. Dying is a profoundly holy experience if you're open to that and if you live into that.
Well, and to add with that, the simple fact of that, when you think of everything that Pastor Burke just said, that to make the death experience as comfortable as possible. You know, like I said earlier, we try to make people comfortable on the worst day of their life. To make that experience as comfortable as possible, not only the person that is dying, but to help the other people around them. I mean, I have seen many extremely admirable people that have just helped their next of kin all the way through the dying process. When we go into pet therapy and animals, I'm 53 years old. I had a minor heart attack when I was 38 years old. And one of the doctors told me that he asked me about my life. And being a funeral director is very stressful. I'm not saying anything for self-pity. This is what I do for a living, and I love it, and I wouldn't do anything else. But it can be very stressful when you take on those responsibilities for families. And so I got a dog. Dogs can be, you know, pet therapy. And now I have 81. So you'd think I have no stress at all. But we have dogs at our funeral home. And some of my retired dogs come down to the funeral home. I saved a dog that had a heart attack in the 2012 Iditarod, and he retired that day, lives up at the house under full benefits. And so he comes down to the funeral home once in a while. And people a lot of times ask for the mush and mortician. And I'll come in and I'll meet with them. And whether I'm down just myself or I bring the dogs with, for just a second, people forget why they're there.
Right.
And it is the neatest thing because it helps them to be comfortable. When you bring pets down and they're with, we encourage family members to bring the pets to the visitation, to bring the pets to the service. I get people say, well, what do I say to his dog? And I just explain to them, just like I tell people that say, I don't think I can come to the visitation, I don't think I can come to the funeral because I don't know what to say to the next of kin. And what I'll tell everybody out there, if you've had this experience or this experience comes up in the future, there's nothing we can say to make this all better, but to be there.
Just be there.
To put your hand on their shoulders, just to be there. And that support is where it's at, because there's an old saying, and I say it over and over again, and we can use it in all different facets of our life, and that is simply, grief shared is grief diminished. Mm-hmm. Even if you look down to it as you're having a bad day and you share it with others, man, I don't know what it is. I just have a bad day. And all of a sudden you share that and it lessens it. Mm-hmm. And that's the important thing about when a death occurs. Open up when the person that is the loved one and the husband just died, as the example. The wife wants to tell that story. She needs to tell that story. But what do we do as supporting friends? We change the subject because this is going to be too hard on her to talk about that. But in reality, we change the subject because it's too hard for us to face this and to deal with it. So the important thing is to be there for support. Mm-hmm. A person that's dying in the hospital or dying at home, go and see them. Yeah. Go and see them. Hold their hand. Let them know you're there. Tell them you love them. And that's the other thing, too, is live every day. You know, like I think there's a country western song, live like you are dying. And if you do that, I'll tell you honestly, being a funeral director has helped me to be a much better person. I think I was a good kid growing up.
And I don't want to cut you off, but we've got a lot of callers, so we're going to keep going here. Jerry, you had a question? I think there's a question for Scott, actually.
Yes, I do. I got just two quick questions. One is, my understanding is people of different faiths, like, for example, Jewish people there, they pretty much demand the body be intact when the body is died of natural causes. Now, when I die, I'm not of Jewish faith there, but is there a way I can ensure that I'm not, you know, gutted out to see the causes of death or, you know, if it's a natural death or whatever, to be left intact just to, you know, and then take it to the funeral home or on that? Is there a way to ensure that, or you got to have the family to do that? How does that work? And the other quick question would be, did you ever have anybody rise up off the slab?
Nope, I haven't had anybody get up off the slab yet, and I get that question a lot, to tell you the truth, and people always ask if somebody moves after death, and that just doesn't happen. But what the first part of that question
about your body? Directive for how your body is treated.
Intact, like example, people of a Jewish faith there, they take the body intact, and that's part of the religious culture.
Right. Well, and the best way to do that would be to, number one, go to the funeral home of your choice and make pre-arrangements. Some call it pre-planning, some call it pre-arrangements. And put down exactly what you would want in the funeral home files, and then take those files to your attorney and have that exact information attached legally to your will. And so that way, specifically, everything is down. Now, say, for instance, you know, you're expecting it's going to be a natural death, but you get in a car accident. In the car accident, someone in another vehicle dies too. Then it comes into the state. And when it comes into the legal ruling for an autopsy, the family can't get in the middle of that. But the best way would be to put that in your will. Say, for instance, you don't want the embalming. You don't want any sort of an autopsy. Because sometimes, even if a person dies elderly, the next of kin is going to want to find do an autopsy to find out if genetically there were any problems. And that is the largest amount of family autopsies, that being where the family requests the autopsy when the legal institution or the hospital hasn't. And they do that for genetic reasons, to find out if there's something they need to worry about in the future.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. That was a great question. I want to read an email that came in, which is back on our topic of preparation, which has turned into kind of a theme of our show on Details of Dying today. Listener says, you can go online and complete an Alaska Advanced Medical Directive, print it out, and get it witnessed. That's an Advanced Medical Directive, AMD. In the AMD, you can spell out what you want or don't want in medical care. You can name a representative who will carry out your wishes if you're incapacitated. I did this AMD, scanned it, and put it on my Google Drive online and shared it with my representative. My will is also scanned and online, only accessible to family members. I have a separate document spelling out my funeral arrangements, property disposition that's not covered by the will. The main thing is to talk to your family and spell out what you want. I want this difficult time for my family to be a bit easier. So that's really good pre-planning by that person, and also use of technology. In other words, it doesn't have to be sitting in a file folder somewhere that nobody knows where it is. You can actually...
Exactly, and I couldn't say that better. That was excellent.
Yeah.
But the important things that she put in there is to make sure that your next of kin knows. Make sure. Think about who is going to make your arrangements. Yeah. Where do you have it? Who'd you make the arrangements with? What do you want? And even if you don't do it with a funeral home, to sit down across from the person that's going to be making your funeral arrangements and tell them what you want. Mm-hmm. And you're going to help them in the long
run.
Maybe
the show will inspire a few people to do that. Let's go to Terry, who has a question or comment. Terry?
Hi there. We recently went through the passing away of my mother-in-law, and she was very well prepared ahead of time. It was a cancer diagnosis, and she died a few weeks later, so we had time to get things in order. But my question is around after her death, what kinds of things need to happen? What kinds of financial things do we need to take care of, and what kind of time frame do we need to follow? She does have, you know, a home that's left her only child, and I'm just kind of unclear as to how to go about handling all that's left to take care of after someone dies.
And let's take that one from the point of view. Yeah, and I'm not sure we can answer that, although we can help people. Right. I mean, I think you probably are going to need an attorney to sort of figure through those, some of those real estate items. And everyone seems to be nodding. It's sort of something that goes beyond our panel here. Agreed?
Right. And that sort of thing, obviously, to contact the attorney. But other things are the contacting of Social Security Administration,
mm-hmm, right,
retirement accounts, and to dig through. Open up the mail.
A lot of details.
Look in the files and see what you need to
Michael?
Do.
Michael?
If you are wondering where to begin to get an overview of all these different areas that you need to be thinking about in preparing for death, there is a resource. It's called Jane Brody's Guide to the Great Beyond. It's 287 pages. That's a practical primer to help you and your loved ones through the medical, the legal, and the emotional end-of-life process. The only thing I would add to all that is in that Jane Brody's guide is if you are an active member of a faith community, talk with your faith community, because many, if not most, churches and synagogues and mosques have files that where you have an opportunity to sit down with a pastor or imam or rabbi and talk about what you would like your service, your celebration of life or funeral to be like, and who would you like involved in that. I know at St. Mary's we have a whole file drawer where people have completely planned out their services and given all kinds of notes as to what they would like to see. And all that, I think, is a great help to family members who actually have to sit down in their moment of loss and grief and are confronted with a variety of questions. About what would mom want, what would mom have wanted. To have it all laid out is a great gift to your loved ones at that time.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I think we've gotten a lot of information out that people want and need. And so much of it seems there's pre-planning, and then there's also sort of taking an attitude of giving and going along with things. And you're probably not going to make bad mistakes if you treat everybody the right way at the, you know, in this situation, right?
Exactly.
So I want to thank each of my guests, Reverend Michael Burke from St. Mary's Episcopal Church, Amanda Richmond from Hospice of Anchorage, Scott Jansen, the mush and mortician from Jansen Funeral Homes. Next week, Hometown Alaska will be taking a break. We'll be airing a show called The State of the Reunion. I'll be interested to find out what that is, along with everyone else. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Grace Bojean is our production assistant, arranged today's show. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfram.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.